Hi, everyone. You're listening to part two of my Gatherings of the Tribe series of shows. I encourage you to check out part one featuring journalists Gus Mastroppa from Wired.com and Chris Dahlin from Killscreen Magazine. Part three, the final in the series, will appear in a few days. In this episode, I'm joined by writers Rob Lefebvre from Games Are Evil and Kirk Hamilton from Gamer Melodico, two critic bloggers like me who cover games and try our best to write about them in thoughtful ways. I invited Rob and Kirk onto the show because I admire their work, and I thought it would be useful to add their perspective as relative newcomers to big events like PAX and GDC. So I hope you enjoy the show. Thanks for listening, and away we go. It is my great pleasure to welcome two more guests to the Brainy Gamer podcast. And in this segment, I'm going to talk to a couple of critics and prolific writers on the net about games, and also two newcomers to the show. So I want to welcome both Kirk Hamilton, who's the editor of a still relatively new site called Gamer Melodico. I'll make the link for the show notes, but if you haven't visited there, you should definitely go. He's not the only writer. A couple of other excellent writers he's working with there. I don't know, when did you start the site, Kirk? How long have you been up?
Well, I guess we started at the beginning of the year. So we started it, about in January, wrote for a month, and, without publishing anything, then started publishing near the end of January this year.
Very smart stuff. And also, I confess I have sort of a soft spot for a community that tries to be positive and keep the trollers away.
And yeah, they don't really come to our site that much. We found it
it's
very
great.
Very negative comments.
It's congratulations on the site, and also it seems like you've been getting a nice bit of traction, which is a hard thing to do these days.
Yeah, it's been cool. We've gotten some nice attention, and it feels like all the readers that I really admire, or the writers that I really admire, are out reading us, which is nice.
Well, great to have you on the show. Welcome. And also Mr. Rob Lefebvre, who is the editor at Games Are Evil. And you oversee more than just Games Are Evil, right, Rob?
Yeah, I do. We actually have the Portable Gamer is our iPhone gaming site. And I just picked up a job over at 148 Apps. So I'm doing the editing over there.
Oh, cool. I didn't know that.
Mm-hmm.
That's fantastic. God, I've read that site forever.
It's a great, Jeff is just fantastic to work for. A real nice guy, real ethical journalist and writer. So
that's wonderful. Yeah, man, they've given me so many tips over the years.
Yeah, it's a great site. I was really excited to become more involved with it.
That's great. I didn't know that. Well, congratulations. Rob and Kirk and I all met for the first time at GDC in San Francisco. And as you know, I've discussed this whole sort of theme for the podcast is gatherings of the tribe. And a little earlier this evening, I talked to Gus Mastroppa and Chris Dahlin, who are kind of longtime grizzled veterans of these kinds of events. And I thought it would be useful to talk to some people who are really newcomers to them and maybe recently had their first experience visiting a conference or an event like GDC or PAX. And so that's what we've got. Rob, your first conference, GDC?
Ever. Yeah.
Uh-huh. Ever?
And, yeah, first gaming conference. You know, I've been to other professional ones, but gaming conference, GDC.
And we'll talk about that, how particularly how GDC differs. I mean, the first time you go to GDC, it's quite an eye-opening experience.
It was overwhelming in a good way. Yeah.
Well, we'll talk about that. And then, of course, Kirk just got back. And in fact, I would imagine he's still unpacking from PAX.
Right. Yeah,
PAX
catching Prime. Up on some sleep, too.
And you posted a lot from there. You tweeted a lot, and you were clearly very busy.
Yes, we were very active, hoping to write some for the blog and then totally didn't write anything at all. So it was that kind of a weekend.
Yeah. It's funny. I discovered that when I started going that I had these big plans. I remember even bringing recording stuff with me. I figured I could do some interviews and, big plans.
I did the same thing.
Right.
It never works.
No. But for good reasons, right?
Oh, yeah. There's so much to do. I mean, every time we had downtime, it felt like just it flew by, and then we had to run out to some other thing. And but it was great. It was just really, really busy weekend.
Well, let's start this kind of the obvious place. And I can relate to this myself. So I'm going to be curious to see how you respond. This, you look forward to an event like this. You've been playing games for a long time. You have your first chance to go to one of these huge get togethers. What do you recall about how it might have been different than you expected or what your impressions were as a first timer?
It's probably the biggest conference I've ever been to in my life. I mean, it was just huge. And I kind of remember walking in and not knowing which building to go into because they're both giant convention center kind of buildings down there. And, you know, is it north? Is it south? Where do I go? I mean, look at all these people. And but even with that just immensity of experience, it was like coming home for me. I felt like, this is where I'm supposed to be. You know, these are my people. These are the, you know, you look around and they're a bunch of nerds like me, you know, wearing badges and goofy shirts and really into gaming. And that was, it was a really good kind of first experience, I think.
What made you decide to go to GDC instead of maybe some other conferences you might've chosen?
Well, I mainly blame you and the different writers that you work with and blog about and all that, because it seemed to me that GDC was more of a thoughtful take on gaming. It wasn't like E3 was the other one that, as a Games Are Evil guy, that would be one of our big conferences. You know, E3, PAX, and GDC are kind of the big three from a console gaming perspective. And GDC seemed to me to be the one that all the more critic types of people were going to. And it also kind of fit in my schedule. So
that
worked out well. Yeah.
Did you find it overwhelming? The programming of it and just so many
events?
So
too many things to go to. There's no way I could have caught all of them. There was at least, I would say, 4 to 7 sessions that I wanted to see every single hour. And there's just no way to get to them all.
Yeah. Did you have a similar experience, Kirk?
You know, it's funny. I live in San Francisco, so it was right on my back door. I remember, Michael, you were talking about you were going to it. I think you were putting together a fund to fly Ben out. And just a lot of talk about GDC. And it wasn't really on my radar until I heard about it. And then I decided, well, okay, I can probably find a way to get into this thing. And so at the last minute, David, a guy who writes with for Melodica, got me just an expo pass because he was working there. So, I didn't know what to expect. I didn't even know that I'd be able to get in until the very last minute. And then, you know, I think we had been talking about I was going to pick you guys up some lunch and come down and meet these people that I knew who were going to be there. And so I did that and then just kind of wandered around and saw what I could see.
It's fun, isn't it, that for me, there's the programming, there's the scheduled events, and there's the cool stuff you look forward to hearing certain people speak. But there's just also the whole getting a chance to meet people that you admire, mm-hmm. people you've been reading for a long time.
Yeah, definitely. I was probably more excited about that than any other one thing about GDC.
Yeah.
Don't tell Chris, but my squee moment was meeting the guy from Edge Online. You know, it was so exciting to me. I was like shivering.
I remember I could recognize him from his picture. I was like, it can be hard to tell, you know, who's who. You know, you expect everybody to kind of look like they look in their Twitter picture. And, you know, then maybe they got a haircut since then. So you're trying to guess, you know, who is this guy? I remember seeing you, Michael, across the way being like, is that him? Oh, yeah, that's definitely Michael.
Yeah. And Chris is, you know, God, he's just the nicest guy in the world. And so is Gus. I have found that feeling of feeling like you're home that you were describing. Mm-hmm. I don't know. I went to academic conferences for many, many years, you know, in my career here. And I just, it became a thing where I just, it's odd. This is what I do, but I didn't feel at home there. I didn't feel like I had a place there and didn't really connect. And I still feel at GDC like I'm kind of an outsider because I'm not a developer. I'm not a designer. But still, that you said it, I think, perfectly. You felt like you were with your people.
Mm-hmm. And there's, you know, there's a large contingent of writers there. And you know, Gamma Sutra did a lot of the sponsoring and, you know, all those people that I've been reading, and they're just there. And you get to meet them, like Kirk just said. You get to meet these people that you've been reading and admiring, and they're all really nice.
That really struck me how nice everybody really was. You know, there's a lot of room for sort of, you have to really put your attitudes out there online when you're writing, and it can start to feel a little bit tough, you know, and then you meet everybody and it's just like everyone is just totally open and nice in real life and getting to just talk, and everyone just wants to talk. Mm-hmm. I thought that was really great and kind of surprising, you know.
Well, Rob, part of the thing about GDC is unlike some fan conferences, it's really intended to teach. There's a whole agenda mm-hmm. there. You know, teaching and learning is a big part of it, and mm-hmm. networking and other things. But did you learn anything when you went? Did you walk away from GDC with a head full of information that you didn't have before?
Well, you know, I kind of got a couple of different things out of it on different levels. One was really gaining a better understanding for the development process of these massive games. I mean, just, you know, Uncharted 2 was a big topic. I went and listened to the writer's talk, the woman who wrote God of War and a couple of things like that. I really got a sense of, wow, there's a lot going on in these games that I just kind of sit on my couch and, you know, press buttons with. And so I gained a bigger appreciation, I think, for just how complex these games are and how do you come out of that crazy sort of math spreadsheet thing with this emotionally resonant game that I can sit on my couch and enjoy as much or more as, you know, than a movie. And so yeah. I really kind of learned a lot of that, more of an appreciation than an academic learning. But then on the other level, I also, you know, I talked with people like Elise Vogel from Crispy Gamer about editing and working with writers and, you know, and how do you motivate people and how do you interest, you know, how do you get the best work out of people? And so for me, a lot of learning was about, you know, my blogging side and, you know, running the small business that we've kind of put together. And so a lot of my learning was in that realm. And I found that just, that's the whole nice thing is these people were, you know, they make money at this. That's their job. Yeah, yeah. And they're willing to sit there and talk to me and kind of, you know, show me the ropes as they see it. And they're really free with information. No one was hiding, you know, this is the secret editor technique. Don't tell him because he'll try to take our job or anything. So it was cool. It was really a nice learning experience on that side too.
Does it make you a better critic?
I think that that comes from the connections and the community, that tribe that you keep talking about, that free flow of sort of, what do you think about this and what does this mean? You know, I always kind of try to go back to the, what does this game mean to us as an individual, as a group of people and as a society? So I think just that open amount of conversation and discussion, I think, did a lot for that.
I thought it was kind of neat to talk to everybody as it was happening, you know, like things people had seen that day. So, you know, what had you seen? And then to read what they wrote about it afterwards, I think was helpful for me as a writer. The idea that you can go, you know, you can go see something, you can process it, you can get down the facts, and then just watching how different writers, you know, whose work I like, sort of processed the event and came up with their own take on it. I thought that was pretty cool.
Yeah. It is interesting too, because you can see, well, I immediately think of Lee Alexander. I happened to mm-hmm. be at several events that she was at. And I was joking with her at a certain point because it just became absurd. She sits down there and I watch her taking notes. She's got her computer and I'm doing the same thing. And the event ends. I walk out. I get in the hall. I look and she's posted.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, she's fast.
Done it. Yeah. And I'm like, I might get to it tonight, you know,
no, man,
when I'm in my,
like,
hotel room.
I'm still finishing up my pack story from, like, you know, 2 days ago. And I'm
thinking, oh, my God. But it does point out, if you care about these things, like how people process ideas, how they write. Mm-hmm. You know, I'm actually interested in people's writing process. And I've gotten a lot faster as a writer since I became a kind of serious blogger. But I'm nowhere and I'll never be anywhere near that. The idea that you can file a story like that and, I mean, that's what a journalist is really different than what I do and what you guys do so much. The reflection process is such a big part of it for me.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, definitely. When I write a piece like this thing I'm working on right now about PAX is this, you know, it's not just, it has some facts in it, but it's mostly just like a take on the whole weekend and this kind of big summary piece. So it just takes a lot longer to write it.
Yeah.
It's different kind of writing. You know, I think a lot of the stuff that we do on our websites that's news-based, like this is coming out, here's some screenshots and here's some details, done. Mm-hmm. I can do that in like 10 minutes, no problem. Yeah, yeah. But if I have to lend any sort of resonance to it, you know, and that, I think that's what Lee does so well, is she can take a post like that and give it some meaning and do it really fast. And that blows me away.
And she's a good writer,
sure, of your
too. I'm sorry, Kirk, what'd you say?
Oh, I said you have to be pretty sure of your convictions if you're going to do that. I feel like when I throw off half-cooked opinions, sometimes on Twitter, I'll have to think about them for a second and really be sure, you know, I know what I'm saying.
Well, Twitter has well, I guess social media in general, but Twitter has changed the way we cover these events, hasn't it?
Mm-hmm. Well, for me, it seemed like GDC was just like a Twitter explosion. I mean, everybody was talking about it. The GDC tag on Twitter was impossible to keep up with. It was going so fast.
So, Rob, you've got one foot in the critical angle, and you're also editing writers who are trying to cover things. But you're also in the middle of a game space that's sort of fast moving, and particularly with Portable Gamer, which is a wonderful site, by the way, people. That you guys have been invaluable to me since I've jumped into the iPad world.
Well, thank you. We actually posted something on your
I saw that. I
so
changed
exciting.
My tune. Yeah.
One of us.
But what that means, it would seem to me, is that you are there also partly to plug in a professional way to this incredibly fast moving target, which is mobile gaming.
Yeah. It changes by the hour. It's a stream. It's not a event.
And so how do you do it? I mean, do you just book a lot of stuff and you try to sort of meet as many people as you can at a thing like GDC? Or how can you possibly stay on top of all the press releases? You
can't. You just can't. I mean, that's really when I picked up the job over at 148 Apps, Jeff kept reminding me, you know, you're going to get 90, 100, 150 emails a day, and you are the filter. You know, as the editor there, I've got to filter out what's A, newsworthy, and B, interesting to our readers, and C, not just utter crap. You know, I mean, you're going to get a wide variety of quality and newsworthiness, for lack of a better term, and you just got to filter through it. And, you know, as I go, I've been doing it about 3 weeks now. First week, man, it took me forever to clear my inbox because I read every single thing. It was really, you know, trying to build that filter. And now I'm by no means fast, but much faster at kind of knowing what's the good stuff and how to get it out there and which writer I'm going to send which story to and that sort of a thing. So
yeah,
it's just a process like anything else.
How do you know, are there earmarks that you see in press releases that say to you, this is something I really need to pay attention to and this is something I just delete right away?
You know, you'd think there would be a secret. And I kind of asked Jeff how he did it. And he said, well, I look at it, and if it's interesting to me, then that's my filter. You know, and that has a whole lot of behind it. Like, he's been doing it for years, and he understands the scene, and he knows people in the industry and all that kind of stuff. But if it perks something in his interest, then he's pretty sure it's going to perk something in, you know, the writers and the readers. So it's just there. You just kind of know it when you see it.
So when you're then at GDC, do you feel like part of your time must be spent?
Yes. Well, you talked about the bringing the, you know, the recording equipment. I brought like a video camera and a still camera and a digital SLR camera and a laptop and a netbook. I mean, I had everything, right? Because I was gonna write during the conference. I was gonna take video. I was gonna take pictures and, you know, send a Flickr and get up and, you know, I maybe got 2 stories out a day if I was lucky. And then spent the whole week after GDC just kind of slogging through business cards and you know, press releases and little thumb drives they give out and all that kind of stuff to try to find the interesting stuff, you know?
Yeah, yeah. And it's not necessarily clear to you at the time what is interesting.
Because you just get into
this mindset where, like, everything's interesting. Like, you just go from one thing to the next, and this is cool, this is cool. Oh, somebody's speaking over there, that's cool. Yeah.
Yeah.
So you got an expo pass, Kirk. You didn't go to sessions at GDC, is that right?
Right, yeah. I didn't really get to go to many of those.
But you got a sense for kind of what the conference was like. One of the obvious questions for me, because I've never been to PAX, is how PAX differs from GDC. I mean, there's some kind of obvious things, I guess, but jumped really into the deep end of the pool with PAX.
I'll say. I mean, well, that, you know, it's funny. I've been looking it up. So it's been running since 2004, which I didn't realize. It seems like it's been going on forever, when really it hasn't been. You know, this was the first year they did PAX East. So it seems to be growing every single year. And it was really different than GDC. I think it's pretty clear the difference. Just, you know, GDC is for game developers, game designers. PAX is for the fan. The panels were interesting. You know, the panels at GDC, and I didn't really get to see many of them, but I got to read about a lot of them. And just the general vibe there was like anything goes. Like, everyone was just talking about, there was new stuff coming out every day. You know, the people at Uncharted 2 would be talking about how they did motion capture, and it'd be blowing everybody's mind. And then the Flower people will be talking about how they did audio and how they did music. And it would be blowing everybody's mind. And it was just, it was cool to be around that kind of energy, like this, just a lot of creativity. PAX was a little more, the games were on display, the new games, the upcoming games, and there were, you know, just lines for everything. But it was much more just oriented towards fans. You know, most of the panels were about how to become a games journalist, you know, how to become a game designer, pitch your idea for your game, that kind of a thing. Which is cool, too, but I didn't think that they were as helpful.
Yeah. What I've been curious about those sessions. The people that conduct them at GDC, it's very clear what's happening there. There's some real sharing that happens. It's just fascinating to me that, you know, you mentioned Uncharted, the way that they just sort of lay everything out to their competitors, really, and just say, here's how we do it. Maybe this, some of this can help you.
Yeah, and there isn't really that kind of energy at PAX. It's interesting. So Warren Spector gave this great keynote at PAX, and he got up there and kind of spent the first half an hour. This is at the new hall that they'd gotten for this year, and it was totally sold out, you know, a million people there, and he spent like a half an hour just going through his CV, basically, just listing every game he's worked on, and with each new game, you know, everyone's going crazy. Wing Commander, like Deus Ex, and people are freaking out. And he gets the crowd in this, like, worked up into a frenzy. Everyone's happy and it's really celebratory. And then he says, but you know, like, we've won. We've won this war we've been fighting for 20 years to be taken seriously by mainstream America. And we seem so unhappy about it. And everyone kind of settles down. And he went on to say this whole thing about how we need to diversify and let more people in and not be, you know, not be this sort of closed off, you know, subculture and become just mainstream culture. And it really surprised me. I thought, I just wasn't expecting it at all. You know, it seemed like he even talked about previous keynote addresses and how they'd said, oh, you know, revel in your specialness. And, you know, he said, okay, revel in your specialness, be special, but open the door for other people too. And that kind of colored a lot of my view of PAX in general. It's sort of a big fan extravaganza. But it also felt kind of fragmented to me. There was not much access. It was really hard to get to the best games. You had to really commit like 4 hours in line if you wanted to go get it. You know, we had media had 1 hour to go ahead of time and check out some games. But even then, there are so many people that it was really hard to see everything. You know, most of the talks, like the really big deal things, had huge lines just going, you know, all the way down the street around the block. And part of that was just the size of it. It was the biggest, you know, PAX has ever been. But it was interesting. Like there's a definite sense of wanting more people there, but also wanting everyone to stay out and just let us do our thing. Let us, you know, play whatever game we want to play and leave us alone.
A lot of the coverage that I saw coming, actually through Twitter, a lot of it, and some of it was from you, was about every other one was about how somebody was standing in a line.
Yeah, I mean, that's constant for PAX. It's lines, and you have to know where to get in line and when to get in line, and it's actually really stressful. If you're not 3 hours ahead of the game, you're not going to be able to get in to, you know, the concert. You're not going to be able to get a wristband, or you're not going to, you know, it's definitely so big that you still need insider knowledge to be able to really see the best thing.
Yeah.
It was kind of it was a constant for the whole thing, this feeling of like, I saw this really awesome thing, but the guy next to me saw something even better, or like he was there earlier, or like everyone was constantly, you know, kind of getting into a whole bunch of things.
Yeah.
And it wound up being the coolest part of it was just seeing a few folks that I knew from GDC or that I know from Twitter and just getting lunch or something. Like that was kind of the best part for me.
Is it too big?
I think it was too big for the venue. I don't think it's too, well, yeah. I mean, considering that they had an East Coast event and PAX Prime, and, you know, there were like 50,000 people at the one, there were probably around 70,000 at PAX. They didn't have a number, but it was too big for the venue. I'm not really sure if it can be too big.
How much of your time at an event like that, I mean, this is, I'll pitch the question about GDC as well, is what happens in the conference and how much of it is what's happening around the conference in terms of your time and your interest, dinners, parties, meeting people, that sort of thing?
I think it's a common theme at all conferences. You know, I've been to so many different special education conferences for my day job that it's really not about the conference after a while. It's about who you meet and who you network with and the stuff that happens around it. And for me at GDC, that was the most impactful part of being there was meeting people, getting to talk to them, going to lunch, just going to dinner, you know, hanging out, seeing people on the floor and waving as you rush off to the next session. That, to me, I think was what it was more about.
I've noticed that at jazz conventions, the International Association of Jazz Educators, which doesn't meet anymore, but that was a that was definitely like you get the sense that that was the only time of the year that a lot of these guys saw one another. They would turn up and, you know, you just see like usually like two super people and you recognize them and they're kind of like, hey, man, like I haven't seen you since last year. Mm-hmm. And like that, I think is a really is a cool vibe. I feel like the people I met at GDC, I then saw at PAX and I probably won't see them again, you know, until GDC next year, maybe.
Yeah. You guys have hinted at this a little bit. I'll ask you to maybe talk about it in more detail, but part of the thing for me about meeting people, not necessarily developers, because you know what they do, they go to work and they make games. Those of us who arrive there from kind of all walks of life, I found that fascinating. You know, like what you do, you mentioned your day job, Rob and Kirk. Obviously, if people followed Melodico, they know that you're a musician. Could you talk a little bit about sort of what you do aside from games and how that might have any impact on your interest in gaming or going to conferences like this?
Yeah, I'm a musician, so that's kind of a broad term, I guess. I play a lot, saxophonist, I play jazz, I write music, I sing, I teach jazz. That's really kind of my paycheck gig is teaching. And yeah, I mean, I think that initially I just got into writing about games because I like video games. And then I, you know, the more I do it, the more I realize that it's giving me a critical outlet that I don't really have otherwise. So you know, when I go to hear people talk about their creative process, you know, how they make games, the nature of the projects that they work on, a lot of it just really resonates with me. It's like getting to see my own process through a different lens and then talk about it in a way that I don't really always love talking about music.
I can so relate to that.
Yeah, I know.
That's like really the bottom line for me, to be honest with you.
That's it for me. Yeah, it feels like I wouldn't want to write music criticism. I don't like talking about music. It's difficult to make it and talk about it at the same time. But I really like thinking critically. And so it's great to think about video games that way. And really like the critical process, you know, the thought process and the creative process have so many things in common across the board, whatever it is you're making, that coming from one angle and looking at it, you know, something else through that lens is just really, really valuable for me.
Yeah, yeah. What about you, Rob?
You know, I think, Kirk, what you said is you started writing about video games because you like video games. That's really why we started Games Are Evil, was just we wanted to be able to play some games that people would send us, you know, free gaming. How great is that? And so, you know, we started just kind of with little games, and then the iPhone hit and we just kind of took that and ran with it. And so there was always this kind of constant stream of games and PR and, you know, how great the next Explodive Fest is going to be. And along the way, I think, you know, my day job is as a, it's more IT these days, but I've been a special ed teacher since probably the mid 90s and have always kind of had an advocacy bent, you know, wanting to kind of help people live as normal a life as possible, as, you know, as included and typical a life as possible. And, you know, that sort of wanting to do a little bit more with my main paycheck gig, like you said, kind of has translated over to the gaming space. Not necessarily like I'm always interested in alternative control schemes and those kind of nitty gritty, you know, directly applicable special eddy kind of things, but really just writing about games for a site like Games Are Evil, which is it's a fan site. It's a early 20s kind of, you know, we like games because they're fun and we like to blow shit up. That's kind of the vibe there. And to be able to get into that, start writing about it, and all of a sudden through, you know, sites like Michael's and writers like we've been talking about, realize there's so much more to the whole gaming scene in terms of just social criticism and why are these games popular? Why do these things sell so well? And, you know, just kind of just opened my eyes to a bigger way to talk about and think about gaming. And so, you know, from the special ed side, education and academia, I kind of got a sense, you know, that when you write about something, you got to write about stuff that matters. And so on the gaming side, I just found out that yeah, they're fun and I like video games, but they actually matter. There's something here that matters to people. And I really kind of, I like to figure out what that is. So I think that's how they kind of connect in my life.
It's interesting to me that this is, I think, partly why when we first connected, and it's very similar with Kirk, that I guess it seems to me that a critic functions as an advocate. And sometimes an advocate has to deliver bad news.
Mm-hmm.
But that there's something about the game space that says there's room for us. And you can feel like you have value in that community. I mean, Kirk, you wrote a piece about Limbo, for example. It was the best piece I've read about that.
Thanks.
I'm not the only person that thinks that. But there's a way that you're approaching that, and there's a way of thinking about writing about games that we're still trying to figure out. And essentially, there's room for us to kind of advocate for things like accounting for experience, thinking about ethical behavior, thinking about, you know, how games communicate values to us, you know, all kinds of stuff that I think all three of us are interested in.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. I mean, that it's interesting. It's cool to me how anything can feel really revolutionary. I remember writing that Limbo review, and special thanks to Jason Killingsworth for running that review. That was really cool. He's my editor at Paste. And writing that and just thinking, you know, well, there's, you know, what can I say about this game? You know, do I talk about the physics system, or, you know, how long it was, or how well made it was? And, it, you know, so to be able to write from an experiential point of view and then have it feel really like this really different thing was cool. You know, when I think about writing about music, I don't really think I could imagine a way to talk about music that you know, no one's doing, or that feels fresh or more relevant than the best, you know, music writers out there. Yeah. So yeah, I think that's pretty neat. And I also really think it's interesting how many, you talk about advocacy sites and, you know, sites like the Border House that have come up, and really, I mean, they take on a lot of topics that people are not comfortable talking about, and that there are people out there doing that. Now it feels like even just this year more than ever before. And some of the stuff that Lee's been writing about gamer culture, she seems pretty fed up with gamer culture lately.
Yes.
And I can't blame her, you know. I mean, the stuff that people say, even just that piece that you wrote earlier this week, Michael, about the Other M review. It seems like there are a lot more people coming out and speaking up in a different way than has been the case before. And yeah, it feels like there's room for me there. It feels like there's room for the, you know, the whole, whatever you want to call it, the brainy sphere, the people who are writing and talking in this way.
Do you look for writers that are sort of up for that challenge, Rob? I mean, you have to kind of manage writers.
God, yes. I tell you, I mean, I'm so new to the paid writer position that I really can't even speak to that yet. But the last couple of years, when we're trying to encourage people who just to come and write with us because it's fun and they like games and they get a free game and, you know, we can talk about this stuff. You find writers that just that really get it, you know, on that level. They really understand that, you know, what video games are, can be, they have their own unique perspective on it. And you just, it's such a nice feeling, you know, to work with writers like that and throw ideas back and forth. And then, you know, you just want to encourage the heck out of those people to keep writing.
Yeah. One of the things I'm curious about, we've talked to several times in this conversation about game culture and, you know, it can be kind of a dark place. But the picture that you get of game culture from GDC, or in particular the one you get from PAX, I guess I'm curious to know what that says to you. It seems to me that Gabe and Tycho are trying to nurture a community that has kind of focused around their strip, but that they're extending it out to communicate, I guess I would argue, a set of values about how we should be and how we should treat each other and what that community should feel like. Am I reaching there in your view, Kirk, or
I think you're right. I got to ask them a lot of questions at the Q&A on Sunday about that very thing, about the size of the event and how they were, you know, how they were dealing with sort of with what Warren Spector said, the idea of diversifying gaming. And yeah, it seems like, you know, they're really idiosyncratic guys. Like Jerry, you know, he just is really in favor of saying things that are true. He has his opinions, but he'll, you know, they'll be at the forefront of, like, most of the questions were about used games, you know, people selling used games, because it's been this huge debate the last week because of something they said. And you get the sense that they're very aware of the fact that anything that they say is going to be taken very seriously by a huge number of people. And so when there's something that they feel they should shine a light on, like in this case saying, look, if you buy a used game, the fact of the matter is the developer is not getting any money for it. And then just letting, you know, kind of seeing where it goes from there. I think that they're really aware of their role there. And yeah, I think for the most part, they're really responsible about it. You know, they'll have the occasional slip up. But they're generally, I think, really, really good about that and really democratic. Like, I think the comic is democratic. It never really feels cruel. It doesn't have a lot of that sort of, you know, negative or more snarky humor that I think a lot of other game humor on the web has. So yeah, I think what they're doing is pretty cool, and they're aware of it, and they're, you know, they're doing it.
Yeah. Did you feel welcome at GDC, Rob? I mean, we've talked about how we kind of function as outsiders there. Mm-hmm. Did you feel like an outsider the whole time?
No, I really didn't, because first of all, I was there as quote unquote press. So, you know, I had the press pads and I went to the press room, and, you know, I was sitting in every session with a little netbook or whatever, typing away or taking pictures. So it seemed like people were welcoming of that. They really wanted to kind of share it with me. And there was people would sit next to me and find out where I was from, and they'd talk about, you know, what they were doing. And it seemed real professional, you know, comfortable and friendly and professional, which to me, that wasn't what I thought gaming culture was before I went there. Yeah. You know, I thought it was a bunch of dudes in their living room, you know, yelling at each other on Halo. So to be able to go and find out that, yeah, these are adults and they're doing what they have passion for, you know, at all levels, that was quite a revelation for me.
So here's my question. This is an honest question. This is not just a rhetorical thing. I you know, Gen Con is kind of right in my backyard here. So I've gone to that a bunch of times, and I've gone to some like really kind of niche conferences like Games for Change and Games Learning and Society, and you know, there's events that happen on the periphery of these major events, and I could say the same thing about every single one. These are really great people. I mean, I really love these people. I'm not just casually using the word. It's warm. It's a warm place to be. People feel like they're in their environment. In my previous segment, Gus talks about feeling like you're home when you're in your PAX, when you're a gamer, especially if you're a young gamer, the first time you go, you're among your kind, you know, and maybe you felt like an outsider in your life, you know, maybe you don't fit in or whatever. And suddenly you're with all these people who are like you. Mm-hmm. And I've never been made to feel like a stranger at GDC, and these smaller conferences as well. So where's all this dark side coming from? You're like, what, you know, are we really looking at a kind of really loud, ugly, dark, vocal minority of people who just kind of, you know, jump on forums and show our worst side? Or, you know, are they really are dominant, like most people in our culture think that gamers are?
Or is it that's such a small subset? I mean, we're talking 70,000 people at a conference. That seems like a lot, but in the greater population, it may not be.
Right.
You know, and the people that can afford to take the time off and get there and stay there and do all that sort of thing. So it's really a self-selecting group. And maybe that's what it, you know, felt like at the conferences is this, we're really glad to be here. We're just glad to be here, you know, Willy Wonka kind of a scene where everyone's just friendly and happy. And, you know, maybe, I don't know, it seems like kind of the, I always think of like the Walmart gamer, you know, or even the GameStop gamer. They just go in, they grab the latest hits and they go home and blow each other up. And, you know, you've experienced them on Xbox Live, and, you know, even PlayStation to a certain extent, people just yelling, screaming, and being homophobic and racist and just nasty. So that's there. I just haven't seen it in any, you know, at GDC or in kind of these sort of circles online.
I think about there's like the real life factor with a lot of those things. I think if you took a lot of the people who, you know, yell the craziest stuff and say the most offensive thing possible, I teach a lot of high school kids. Mm-hmm. And I think that a lot of them are on Xbox Live just trying to come up with the absolute most offensive thing they can say. But when they're in class, they're perfectly nice kids. Mm-hmm. I think sometimes if you flew, you know, 500 people who had, you know, gotten on Kotaku and left some really crazy comments or gotten on Xbox Live and called someone terrible names, if you flew them out to PAX, I don't know if they wouldn't be trash talking the entire convention. I think they'd be having a great time and they'd be grinning ear to ear and taking pictures of cosplayers and walking around just like everybody else. Yeah, so there's a removal that happens. It's the, well, there's even there's a Penny Arcade about it. It's like the greater mm-hmm. internet dickhead theory or something like that.
Yeah.
And you know, the minute you give someone the internet an anonymity, you know, they just become a complete jerk. And I think there's something to that, for sure.
Maybe, yeah. I think that's very helpful because I know even in my own case, my son is he'll, you know, Facebook post or he'll play Xbox Live and you can hear him. And it's sometimes I think, my God.
I'm sure
God,
he's a huge trash talker too. I can totally
see this. He is. I think, my God, what happened? You know, how did we go so wrong? And on Facebook, I'm the old guy. So, you know, I'll just be the old guy here. But I there's a level of, I don't know what you call it, trash talk or just casual kind of like offensiveness where you're just kind of in each other's face and saying like nasty stuff. And it's all just, it's actually not taken seriously.
Mm-hmm.
And I think it's serious and I'm all, you know, troubled by, you know, some of the stuff he seems to say. And, you know, some of it borders on like racist kind of epithets and, you know, like stuff that's really kind of deeply offensive to me. Mm-hmm. And I talked to him about it and I see this happening, you know, in game forums and they're like, yeah, you know what? It's not that big of a deal. We don't take it seriously. And I, you know, part of me thinks you need to take it more seriously. And part of me thinks, wow, I think I'm just out of touch here.
Don't get me started on the whole "that's retarded" thing. I mean, that's like the worst. Yeah. It's like the N-word for the special ed community, you know.
Yeah,
and you just hear it, and it really, they don't, people that say it that casually don't get it, and I'm still trying to figure out, like you're saying, is it really that they're just not understanding how offensive it is, and they don't care, or has it become something else?
Yeah. I think there's a big question about privilege going around right now, or at least it's something I've been thinking about the last year. You know, my own privilege in general in life, how, you know, things that don't offend me that would offend someone else. You know, for example, retarded. That word is deeply offensive. I remember using the word lame to describe something, and then realizing, you know, being told, dude, that's kind of ableist language. You know,
right.
And it made me think about my language a lot more, and just about the fact that I'm, you know, I'm privileged enough to not be offended or triggered or whatever by the kind of language that flies around all the time on the internet.
Right.
And that kind of, like, talking about privilege, even that word, is really hard for people. You tell them that they're privileged and they're immediately, you know, go into defense mode. Mm-hmm. And it's a trick. It's like one of the biggest, yeah, this isn't just for gaming, just for the internet in general. In a place
life.
Where anonymity is allowed, you know.
Yeah.
I think it's like the biggest challenge is getting people to acknowledge their own privilege and the privilege of others.
Well, it does strike me that there's an event like PAX, and also GDC, but in a different way. It's useful for us to show our best face sometimes, and it's useful when you step into the arena there that there are certain expectations that are just sort of community decided upon. Chris Dahlin was talking about, you know, he went to PAX a couple of years ago and he had a press pass and, you know, he if you have a press pass, you can cut in line and you can, you know, you have certain privileges. And it became clear to him quickly that that was just not cool.
Yeah, no, definitely.
Right. You just don't do that. And it's an ethos thing that the community has developed at PAX. It's probably a reflection of the leaders who've established it. I don't mean to beat a dead horse here, but I just find it interesting the way that it's possible to help a culture that's kind of in, it's still in formation, learn how to find its way through modeling a certain kind of discourse, through modeling a certain set of behaviors that are expected.
Right.
And that in fact, it's possible to make some progress with that.
Yeah. Well, each of these communities we're talking about, and I'm sorry to cut you off, but like each little community is its own, has its own little expectations of behavior. You know, the Halo Online, you're encouraged to talk like that. You know, you're encouraged to trash talk and be mean, and you're going to use, especially if you're, you know, a younger person who's just figuring out how to be a person. And each of these communities kind of set up expectations. And like you said, if you set them up in a way that you value, then those values will hopefully kind of go through that whole community.
Yeah. It comes down to leadership too, I think, a lot of the time. I mean, you know, having the fact that there are now war inspectors of the world and there are these people out there sort of modeling behavior for everyone else. And they're, you know, they're beloved. They're for real. They've earned it. They're not elected officials, you know, they're elected, but they've been elected by like, you know, the last 20 years of work. I think that that's helpful. And I think that a lot of the communities where there isn't that kind of oversight, you know, just the internet at large, it feels like a more like decentralized almost, you know, there's no government. It's just a bunch of cells operating on their own and there's no one modeling behavior. There's just a flame everywhere. Yeah. That sounds dark.
Whee! Well, we're just about out of time, so I wanted to transition here, talk a little bit about a game that you might have played recently that you'd like to recommend to the listeners. Could you shine your light on something that we ought to be playing?
You know, I haven't played a new console game since Red Dead Redemption. And I still throw it up there from time to time just because I like to ride my horse around with the moon, you know. But I really haven't. I've played a few downloadable games on there and stuff like that. But because I work a lot in the iPhone and iPad gaming space now, you know, there's so many really interesting and neat games in that space, but there's not a lot of fully realized games. And I think that it's, you know, kind of the fun thing is figuring out which those fully realized games are. And the one I keep coming back to, it bothers me that I like this game so much because it's such a, it's a EA game. It's, you know, it's a big name game, is Mirror's Edge. I've been playing it on the iPad and it is just fun.
It is terrific.
I mean, it's fluid and it makes sense. And you know, it's fantastic implementation. The story's great. I've always loved the story from the console version, but you know, just having it in that sort of fake, you know, 2D, 3D kind of vibe and the way the controls, I just keep going back and playing it. So,
you know, it's a great game.
My pick.
Have you been playing that game? Have you played that game on the original release of it, like on 360 or PS3?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I have.
Because I've actually just been playing that game for the first time and I'm really interested in seeing what the iPad version looks like.
Well, they're totally different in the sense that one is very much a 2D game with some 3D, you know, kind of settings, that the whole disorienting part of the console version that what makes it difficult is its 3D-ness often.
Right. Definitely.
This is a different game.
But again, I think it's a fully realized game. You know, it's not just a quick sort of you know, let's just cash in on the iPad, you know, on the iOS scene. It's a full game with the Mirror's Edge universe fully intact, and I really appreciate it.
I'm so glad you mentioned this because I was online playing with this. I'm part of this group called the VGHVI. It's a Video Games and Human Values Initiative. People, we play on Thursday nights, sort of collectively play games. And we were playing Portal the other night and we were Skyping while we were playing. It was kind of a neat thing to do. And, well, what games are you playing? And I said, I had been playing Mirror's Edge for the iPad. And they were all just like, huh?
What?
What? Uh-huh. Why would you play that? Like, what? And they, of course, most of them really didn't like the 3D version. So it is this crazy odd thing. Yeah, EA, it's this big game. It's a high profile, you know, AAA publisher. Mm-hmm. But really, it doesn't seem like anybody knows about it.
No.
Yeah, I remember when they talked about it, seeing some screenshots somewhere and thinking it looked kind of neat and then not really hearing anything else about it after it got
launched. Because it's an iPhone game. No one cares. I mean, yeah, really, right. That's kind of the sense I get is like, oh, it's that, you know, it's Bejeweled. It's a casual game. Don't worry about it. Mm-hmm. You know, and there's so many experimental, funky, crazy, you know, interesting games out there in that space that it's a fun place to be in. So yeah. I'm gonna go with Mirror's Edge and then turn it right over to Kirk.
There you go. The man's on a crusade. We're gonna teach people this portable gaming.
It's a valid way to game. Yeah.
Before we do, let me just ask you real quick. Have you played the Epic Citadel?
Oh my gosh, it's brilliant looking.
Can you even?
I can't believe it.
I showed my wife this last night. I showed it to her on both the iPhone and the iPad. Mm-hmm. And I mean, she sees me play games so much that nothing interests her. Nothing.
Right.
I mean, her jaw dropped.
Yeah. It's amazing. I showed it to someone who's not a gamer and she was like, oh my God, you can look up. I can see the moon, you know, and that's stuff you take for granted on the console, and even down to the little dual stick controls to move around if you want to, but yeah. You don't have to.
Yeah. But it works.
It's like holding a console game in your hand. You know, I mean, I hate to say it, but PSPs are done. they're done. There's nothing to recommend them anymore.
Well, it is Epic's Unreal Engine running on an iPhone.
Mm-hmm.
When Steve Jobs showed it, you know, I mean,
did you see him at the end? Yeah.
It's a phone.
I know. That was fantastic.
But, you know, that group is getting less and less. His ability to wow his audience is getting less and less as he goes along. You know, it's just like more stuff and more stuff. And they were just knocked on their heels when they saw that. The whole room, you could just tell.
Yeah. We're seeing that convergence that we all wanted when the first portable gaming systems came out. We wanted a console experience that we could carry around with us. I think we're getting close to it with these devices.
Yeah, and I got to say, I didn't want that. I mean, I really thought these devices just, and I sort of feel that the PSP the same, actually don't give me a console experience.
No,
it's too much.
They
I don't
have.
Want it. And, I'm happy not to have it. I think actually that, you know, a game like Bejeweled is a great game to play mm-hmm. on the iPhone. And, you know, let's be fine with that. Don't make me, you know, you're not failing on this little handheld unit because you can't do what the consoles can do. Mm-hmm. But this thing, which now let's say it's a tech demo, so it's not like a whole game or anything. It's just a proof of concept, really. Here's what we can do with this. But I got to say, I'm...
I'm ready. I'm ready to see what comes out of that.
Ah, me too.
Stunning.
Yeah. Okay, so yeah, we will toss the ball to Kirk.
All right. Well, it's funny. I actually am very much on the same page as Rob with downloadable games. And I really dug like some of the bigger games earlier this year. I really liked Mass Effect and Red Dead Redemption was pretty cool. I had, but it was, you know, I think that the game I'm playing right now that I love more than anything else is Lara Croft and the Guardian of Light.
Oh, that's good to hear.
It's an amazing game. I totally didn't expect it. You know, a roommate of mine worked at Crystal Dynamics for a long time. So I got to talk to him a lot about, you know, he worked on, I think, Underworld and the one before that. And, you know, these kind of just diminishing returns on the Tomb Raider thing. And just, I don't know, I love the original Tomb Raider game, but I hadn't played a game in a long time set in that world, you know, starring Lara Croft. And then this game kind of came out of nowhere. I mean, there have been a ton of great downloadable games on console this year. I think every game I've really, truly loved this year. I mean, Limbo was an amazing game and downloadable, nice, short and sweet. Angry Birds, I'm completely addicted to on iPhone. I think that's like a really awesome,
yeah,
awesome
it's game. A lot of fun.
And you know, there are these kind of smaller experiences. Lara Croft, obviously, you know, that's not that small. Also, Deathspank, that wasn't a small game. I loved it, but, you know, it was, you know, 15 hours long or something. And it's interesting to see that space, like to find that there's a sweet spot there for me. Like that, I mean, Lara Croft, that game, it's almost like playing I don't even know, like a drum solo or something. The music just gets pumping. Have you guys played it?
Mm-mm, not yet.
No, I'm really interested. I would have written it off if people hadn't talked about it, to be honest.
It's got this sense of momentum to it, you know, and you just run it and you run it and these things attack you and you kill them and then you know, you solve a puzzle and it makes me feel really good about myself, like, which is a weird thing for a game to make me feel, but I feel smart when I'm playing it. Like you know, there's a puzzle coming and I figure it out like on the fly and I get through it. And then, you know, even if you die, you kind of just keep playing. And it's just like a really gratifying experience. It's cleverly designed. The puzzles are really well made. They're, you know, just hard enough. I haven't beaten it yet, but I know it definitely gets harder as it goes. It's varied. It's great looking. And yeah, I mean, it's the most purely enjoyable game I've played in a really long time.
Fantastic. Cool. We should just mention too, just jog my memory about this. If you're a PS3 gamer and you for whatever reason, you haven't been able to play some of those cool games you've seen some of your pals playing on 360, Castle Crashers is now available for
it is. PS3. That was so exciting.
Oh God, that's such a
fun
game.
What a great game.
Oh man. Yeah.
But you know, yeah. Your point, Kirk, about the downloadable games is that they're not these monolithic $60 investments. You know, they're $10, $12, $15 maybe at the most. And it almost seems like the ease of entry is just as much a part of my happiness with those games as anything else.
Yeah, you know, I definitely agree. And it's funny, there's this kind of cost benefit analysis on gaming right now, which is weird. A lot of people talked about it with Limbo. That if you get a shorter game, you know, you're not getting as much money's worth. But at this point in my life, I kind of look at it the other
exactly.
way around. You know, like a $60 game, okay, like I get $1 per hour, but also like I have to play it for 60 hours and I'm worth more than $1 per hour. You know, I should be building the company after a certain point. And so playing Limbo, which is just in and out and over, you know, Portal's a game I can play. I've played that game like 4 times now just because it's short enough that it's manageable. Dragon Age was an amazing game, but there's just no way that I can see everything that game has to offer. I'm not
going to finish.
Yeah. Well, we should also include DLC here, and you'll get something like Minerva's Den for BioShock 2.
Oh, which I really want to check out.
Oh, yeah, it's really good. If you liked BioShock 2,
I love BioShock.
Yeah, me too.
I did too.
Oh, love that game, and yeah, they really did this right. I'm going to write about this. I guess a lot of people probably will because it's worth thinking about how a developer can take a universe that's kind of well established and say, in a way, they almost sort of say goodbye to it. Then you play it and you get to the end of it. And this is about, it seems to me, this is about all that they'll be able to do with Rapture. And if you really thought Rapture was one of the great video game universes, this is a real fitting way to say goodbye to it.
Wow. That's an endorsement.
Yeah. It's really cool. Truth in advertising here. It's, you know, level designer was Steve Gaynor. He's been on the show, and you know, I love Steve. He's awesome. And so maybe I'm not objective enough. I don't know, but
whatever.
Yeah, he's pretty brilliant. So there's gotta be something to it.
Yeah, he is. Well, gentlemen, you've been very generous with your time. I'm sorry we went a little over, but this has been a great conversation. It's been really great to have both of you on the show.
It's been an honor. Thank you, Michael.
It's totally been a pleasure. Yeah. Thanks, Michael and Rob.
Well, we'll have to do this again soon and get you back on, and we can maybe talk about some of our favorite games of 2010. We'll
Absolutely.
Do that series of shows here soon. So
sounds great.
Mm-hmm. All right. Well, good evening, gents, and I hope we bump into each other soon, maybe at GDC.
Yeah, sounds good.
Take care, guys.
Yeah, take care.